I'm going to begin my sermon today with a few words about my sermon writing process. One of the ways that I've always wanted to improve as a preacher is that I've always wanted to be better about planning ahead. Having some sense of where I want the sermons to go over time is helpful. It's helpful for the musicians with whom I work. It's better for planning things thematically in celebration. It's also good because it helps me make sure the same sermon doesn't get repackaged and re-preached week after week. And it's better stylistically. You know, there are different kinds of sermons. There are prophetic sermons that speak on public issues. There are teaching sermons that are more informational. And there are pastoral sermons that are more spiritual in nature. And if I plan ahead, I can do a better job of making sure I do all different kinds of sermons. But for the last 25 years of weekly preaching, for whatever reason, I've seldom been able to get sermons mapped out more than 6 weeks in advance. And I recognize this as a weakness. And so back in September, I decided that I would do something different. I was going to plan out my sermons all the way to the end of the year. I chose scripture lessons and rough ideas for each sermon, and then Talitha and Kim and I met together, and we came up with ideas for hymns and other ideas for celebration, and it was a good and rewarding process. So now I've set aside some time next week, and I'm going to plan all the way from the new year till Easter. I'll see if I can pull that off. I'm telling you this because I wanted to let you know that I decided to preach on this morning's passage from Ruth more than a month ago. And my plan was to make the sermon pastoral in nature. The challenge I gave myself was to preach a sermon about immigration that didn't focus on the politics of immigration. That's hard for me. I wanted to make sure that we remembered, because this is Remembrance Sunday, I wanted to make sure that we remembered that everyone, nearly everyone living in California, is descended from immigrants, and how some of our ancestors were victims of forced migration because of slavery or perhaps because of things like the clearing of the Scottish Highlands. Some of us are descended from people who immigrated to the United States because life was really hard and conditions were really difficult in their countries of origins. Other Americans are descended from people who came to the United States to escape religious or political persecution. But, and this is what I wanted everybody to remember, very few Americans are descended from people who came here because life was great in the country of their birth. That's true for some people, but almost nobody came here for that reason. Most Americans are descended from people like Naomi and Ruth from this morning's lesson from the book of Ruth. Naomi immigrated from Judea to Moab during a famine. There, her sons married Moabite women, including Ruth. And then when disease left both Naomi and Ruth and Orpah as widows, left them facing economic catastrophe because they were widowed, then Naomi and Ruth chose to migrate again, this time from Moab back to Judea. Most people in the world, that means those who have migrated into the United States and those who migrate across borders elsewhere in the world, the vast majority of people who migrate, migrate for the kinds of reasons that caused Naomi and Ruth to migrate. And in the sermon that I planned out, I was hoping to prompt you to remember why we migrate. And I wanted you to remember why people migrate, including all of our ancestors. I wanted you to remember why we migrate as a way of prompting a greater sense of neighborliness in our communities. The idea being that if we remember our story or our stories of immigration, then we might have increased compassion for immigrants whose American stories are just now beginning. Of course, those of you who know me, and most of you know me, know that I probably couldn't have hidden my political feelings in such a sermon. But this is really important. I still believe, I have faith that regardless of what a person may think about specific immigration policies, that person still can look at an immigrant as a human being with whom they share a common human story. For indeed, migration is a common human story. After all, the book of Ruth is probably at least 2,500 years old, and it is a story about immigration. And if we've been talking about immigration for that long, we've probably been talking about immigration for longer than that. And if we remember and tell our immigration stories properly, then these stories can serve as a point of spiritual connection between people who might otherwise not be connected in a neighborly way. So that's what I was going to talk about. And then this last week happened. Our nation was reeling from the deadliest anti-Semitic violence ever on American soil. We were recovering from the thwarting of the largest ever mass assassination attempt. And we were grieving racist attacks on elderly African-American shoppers at a Kroger's in Jeffersontown, Kentucky. With that tragic backdrop as a set on the American political stage, the president let it be known that he was going to attempt to amend the United States Constitution using an executive order such that U.S.-born children of undocumented persons would no longer be citizens, and that the planned deployment of maybe 800 soldiers to the border would be beefed up to as many as 15,000 military personnel. The deployment was designated to thwart the migration of a band of several thousand immigrants and refugees, many of whom are very young and some of whom are quite old. These are poor folks who are walking up from Central America. The group is unarmed, but the president let it be known that if anyone so much as threw a rock at the military was to respond with bullets. I know enough about the history of immigration to know that this is not the first time the United States has used racism to set immigration policy. It's not the first time that the United States has used violence to implement racist immigration policy. But what breaks my heart is that I thought things were getting better. I feel cheated out of a future in which I hoped I might see the arc of the moral universe bend towards justice. I feel cheated. And that breaks my heart. Let's be clear. To speak out in favor of denying citizenship to those born on U.S. soil is to speak out against an amendment to the Constitution that reversed some of the worst implications of the Dred Scott decision, which denied citizenship to African Americans. To call up the most powerful military in the history of the universe in response to a caravan of impoverished Central American migrants is nothing more than an act of international bullying. It makes about as much sense as using a pneumatic jackhammer to do Finnish carpentry. To suggest the use of deadly force in response to rock throwing is a war crime. All of which is to say, please vote on Tuesday. But I think we need to do more than vote. And this brings me back to the spiritual message that I originally planned to give today. I hope you will remember your own family's immigration stories. And being inspired by those stories, I hope you will grow in your ability to welcome immigrants into your communities and into your lives. And this, by the way, is this pattern of memory and welcome. This happens to be the biblical model for how local populations should respond to immigration. The Bible is explicit about this. Under the law that, according to tradition, Moses handed down to the Hebrew people, Israel was meant to be a place where immigrants would be treated with kindness and justice and equality under the law. For example, farmers were required to leave a portion of their grain in the field so that poor people, including widows and orphans and migrants, could have access to food. And the message was always this: be kind to immigrants, because you were immigrants in the land of Egypt. This is making reference, of course, to the time when the people of Israel lived in Egypt as slaves. This was a deeply ethical rule. Remember what it was like to live as strangers in Egypt, and then treat immigrants the way you wish the Egyptians had treated your ancestors. It was a good rule then, and it's a good rule now. And you see this playing out in the story of Ruth. We didn't read the whole story of Ruth, but I hope you will read the whole story of Ruth. It's a great book. It's not going to take you too long. We just read the first chapter of the story of Ruth. But in the story, after Ruth and Naomi migrate to Judea and settle in Bethlehem, which was Naomi's hometown, after this happens, Ruth takes advantage of local laws and customs in two ways. First, we ended our reading today with this word that the barley harvest was about to happen. And what happens during the barley harvest is that Ruth goes to the field and harvests leftover grain in the field of a local farmer. Because, as I've said above, the law required farmers to leave a portion of their crops for the poor, including widows and immigrants, and Naomi was both of those things. But Naomi also took advantage of local law and custom by seducing the farmer and eventually marrying him. Now, I suspect there was probably a good deal of old-fashioned attraction and romance between Ruth and the farmer, but the farmer in question happened to be a distant cousin of one of Ruth's late husband's. So the farmer is one of Ruth's late husband's distant cousins. And so Ruth was taking advantage of a provision in the law which said that when a woman is widowed before she has children, her late husband's family is on the hook to provide her with another husband and eventually with children. So Ruth was taking advantage of that. And the law also said that these rules were applied not just to citizens, but to immigrants as well. Now, let's be honest. In the modern world, this law about a widow marrying a relative of her late husband, if she has no children, that seems a little weird. But in a society where women seldom had economic agency and where elderly people relied on their children to keep them housed and fed, it made sense. And Ruth claimed the protections of the law for herself, even though she was an immigrant. Ruth benefited from a humane set of immigration laws that were based in memory. And in fact, it wasn't just Ruth who benefited, but all of Israel benefited. Because thanks to her marriage to the farmer, Ruth had a great-grandson named David. And David became the greatest king in the history of Israel. Now, one of the biggest concerns articulated by those who fear immigration is that immigrants will somehow change the character of the place to which they were migrating. And you know what? Those people are right. Immigrants do change the places to which they are migrating. And more often than not, that is a really good thing. Ruth's presence in Bethlehem was good for the kingdom of Israel. And I'm firmly of the belief that the United States gets better with each wave of immigration. Think about it. The first significant wave of European migration brought genocide and slavery to North America. But over the years, the arrival of migrants who were not from Northern Europe and were not Protestant, Catholics from Italy and Jews from Eastern Europe, for example, and people from Latin America and Asia, this migration has gentled the American soul by providing something of a counterbalance to the violence of earlier Protestant European migrants. So on this day set aside to remember our ancestors, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do the soul work of remembering what I know of the migration stories that brought the various strands of my family to North America. And I hope you will do the same. I'm going to remember the fact that my Anabaptist ancestors came here to escape religious persecution. I'm going to remember that my Scottish ancestors were forced off the tiny island of Gia in the Inner Hebrides when the English enacted a program of collective punishment against the Scottish people in the aftermath of the Jacobite Wars. I'm going to remember my Irish ancestors who were facing starvation because of a potato blight. I'm going to remember my Italian great-grandparents who, as teenagers, got themselves in what might be the oldest kind of trouble for two teenagers to get themselves into. This was trouble that would have brought humiliation to their families in the tight-knit and traditional communities in which they lived. And so my great-grandparents migrated from northern Lombardy to Vermont, and they had the captain of the immigrant ship marry them so that my grandmother could escape the curse of what cruel people might call illegitimate birth. As I tell these stories, I will allow the stories to inspire in me a sense of neighborly kinship with those who cross borders today, and I hope you will do the same. And I hope you will join me on this day set aside to remember our ancestors. I hope you will join me in bringing immigrant stories with you when you come to the communion table in a few minutes. For the communion table is meant to remind us, among other things, that we are part of God's family. We are God's adopted children. And as such, we come to this table from north and south and east and west, from all over. And together we sup with a great multitude in this city of God. This city of God, where in the fullness of time, we all will dwell together as immigrants. Amen.